Welcome to Chasing American History. My name is David Cross, and today we're going to jump right into our George Washington 101 series. We're going to be spending a number of episodes looking at the life of George Washington. And so I think it's fair to begin this series of episodes by asking the question, why? Why study George Washington? Why take the time to look at the lives of the founders of this country? What are we getting out of doing this? Now, once upon a time, this question that I'm asking may have seemed like a rhetorical question. It may have seemed like a question that anybody could answer. But it's a legitimate question today because to many people, not just people who don't want to have to go through studying history, but professors, academics, there's many people who might tell you that it is a complete waste of time to enter into history by looking at the biographies of the so-called great men and women. And there are a lot of people that think this is just an incorrect, improper way to do things. Studying history by looking at biography has been called the great man theory. Thomas Carlyle was a Scottish philosopher, historian, a conservative monarchist, and he wrote in his On Heroes and Worship, "Universal history of what man has accomplished is but the history of the great men sent into the world. The soul of the whole world's history, it may justly be considered, were the history of these." Have you ever been in the position of feeling strongly for a particular point of view and then having somebody argue it in such a way that you really want to distance yourself from that person? Maybe for years you've studied the JFK assassination and you think there's a lot of serious questions to be asked. And then one day you got lumped in with Oliver Stone and some of the fallacies that are in his movie. Needless to say, after Thomas Carlyle wrote about his great man theory, a lot of people argued against it, most famously Herbert Spencer. 11 years later, he was going to write a book called The Study of Sociology. He was a pioneer of sociology, a social evolutionist, and he wrote this: "If the great men could really remake his society nonetheless must have previously made him. He is merely the proximate initiator. A real explanation of such changes must be sought not in the great man himself, but in the aggregate of social conditions." Huh. So take a moment to think about what Herbert Spencer is saying. That the world operates in such a way that there are conditions, some of them almost impossible to see, but conditions that exist out in the world that are really going to create somebody as a manifestation of those conditions. And so that to look at that person is probably improper because he's merely the manifestation of social conditions and millions of people whose names we don't know. Looking at the so-called great man is missing the point of history, because what you should be looking at is the conditions that created the so-called great man. And certainly, Spencer has a valid point. Clearly, conditions are going to have a vital part in creating the great individual. I always found it amazing that Charlie Parker was living in Kansas at the same time Dizzy Gillespie was living in New York, and both of them came up with bebop, a highly idiosyncratic type of music. And you can only believe that this is possible if you agree with Spencer, that it's a waste of time to study Charlie Parker or Dizzy Gillespie. The reason they were both able to create this music is that they're both manifestations of what's going out there in the world. And really, there's no other explanation for the fact that these two people were able to create music that was not identical, but had so much similarities in terms of approach, in terms of some of the harmonic foundations, revolutionary changes that each of them were making in their own place. many people say, that's the way history is created. It's by looking at these conditions that we can understand history. So why are we looking at the life of George Washington? Why are we following the biography of George Washington? I'll answer that both from a personal standpoint and from a less personal standpoint. Personally, I have only been interested in history when I view it as biography. And I'm sure there are many people like myself. As a matter of fact, I know that there are many people like myself. Because when I give lectures or give tours about American history, I'm often told, I would have been interested in history if my teacher had been like that, if he told stories, if it wasn't just names and dates. The way I learned history was that, first of all, I was in school, I was in music school, and I happened to pick up a book called Johnny, We Hardly Knew Ye. That's a book by Larry O'Donnell and Dave Powers, a very romantic portrayal of John F. Kennedy. And so I read that book, and I was interested in this Bobby Kennedy character. I wanted to learn more about him. So I learned everything I could about Bobby Kennedy. I was lucky enough to go into a bookstore owned by a nice gentleman who told me, well, I have two books on Bobby Kennedy, and he gave me Arthur Schlesinger's biography of Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy and his times, and he also gave me Jack Newfield's memoir about Robert Kennedy, and I was absolutely transfixed by these books. They changed my life, and I had to know everything I could about Robert Kennedy, and that grew into wanting to know everything about his time. That grew every direction you could go. I wanted to understand John Kennedy if I was going to understand Robert Kennedy. And I wanted to understand this man John Kennedy ran against, Dwight Eisenhower. I needed to understand about Joseph McCarthy. So I can remember going, I was living in Boston at the time, and I remember going into the Boston Public Library and just getting all of these books of all of these different people, these tentacles of what I was studying going off in all directions. I began a lifelong love of Bob Dylan's music because I needed to hear Bob Dylan, because Robert Kennedy had talked about him, Jack Newfield had talked to him about Bob Dylan, and so I needed to know about that. I had to read Camus because Robert Kennedy talked about Camus. I had to read Edith Hamilton and The Greek Way, and that led me into other led me into Aeschylus, which I had to read. So once you start going down this pathway, you're going to learn about the conditions. You might pick up a book about Martin Luther King Jr., but certainly you're going to read about the social conditions that put Martin Luther King Jr. into the position he ultimately attained. But Martin Luther King Jr., even though he cannot be understood without looking at his surrounding times and the people around him, he's still a great man. And if he hadn't been there, life would have been different. There are people like that. There are people who have such a strong impact on those around them that they really change the course of history. When he was a little boy, the story is told, Winston Churchill was asked what he wanted to do when he grew up, and he said, save Western civilization. And there are many who believe that he did save Western civilization. George Washington had an impact on this country that was profound. And I'm not going to go into that impact too much on this episode, because that's what all of these episodes are really about. But suffice it to say, without George Washington, we might not win the revolution. Without George Washington, if we do win the revolution, we might not have a constitution. Without George Washington, if we do have that constitution, it will certainly be very different from the one we have. And without George Washington, our view of the presidency and the way the president acts would be completely different from how it is because of George Washington. This is the impact that this one man had. And you could say that you don't believe in the great man theory, but there are simply a number of lives and of a number of great individuals that are going to put a lie to the notion that there are no single individuals who have great impact. Oh, you could say that they're just a manifestation of the society around them, and in many ways they are. George Washington wouldn't be George Washington if he didn't live at the time he lived. Thomas Jefferson would not have written the Declaration of Independence in the way he wrote it if he had not been touched by the fire of the Enlightenment. But a lot of people around Thomas Jefferson were touched by the fire of the Enlightenment. But it took Thomas Jefferson to write the Declaration of Independence. There were a number of people furious at England. There were a number of people who wanted to fight a revolution against England. It took George Washington to lead that revolution. And so that's why we're going to take a look at George Washington. I mean, I kind of skipped over the whole why George Washington question. Because after we ask the question, why study leaders at all? Why study so-called great men and great women? Then becomes the story, why Washington? Why do we need to know Washington? And I would say, first of all, George Washington is the founder that I think we know the least. I don't think we know this man very well. And I think we've lost touch with him. Nathaniel Hawthorne once wrote that Washington was born with his clothes on and his hair powdered and made a stately bow on his first appearance in the world. It's been, for quite a long time, easier to make fun of George Washington than to admire George Washington. And now we know George Washington as the person who sells cars on once a year on what was called Washington's birthday, what's now called, by most people, President's Day. The picture we have of George Washington is a pretty atrocious one. It's the picture we have on the dollar bill, painted by Gilbert Stuart. And I guess it wouldn't surprise anybody, if you're listening to this right now, pull out your wallet. Take a look at, if you got a dollar bill, if you're lucky enough in this day and age, take a dollar out of your wallet and look at that man's face. He doesn't really look like a man people would follow into battle, does he? He looks sour, old, clearly an issue with the teeth there. He looks pissed off. Part of the reason for that is he wasn't particularly enamored with Gilbert Stuart, who was painting his portrait. Gilbert Stuart was the kind of person who, when he painted a subject, tried to get to know him and tried to create a quick intimacy. That didn't work with George Washington. He was not a man you could create a quick intimacy with. And he said to George Washington, "Now, sir, you must let me forget that you are General Washington and that I am Stuart the painter." Washington listened to this, and he responded that Mr. Stuart need not forget who he is or who General Washington is. Part of the reason he looked so miserable is probably that A, he hated standing for portraits, and B, he didn't particularly like the person who was painting this portrait. But let's face it, George Washington was not around to be anybody's buddy. You've seen the TV shows where people say, "I'm not here to make friends." George Washington wasn't around to make enemies, but he wasn't there to make friends either. He was a little set off from all of the rest of them. It was as if he had to create this persona in order to lead the country, but in doing so, it cut him off from a lot of the people around him. There's a story, could be apocryphal, about George Washington and Gouverneur Morris and Alexander Hamilton. And so the story goes, Alexander Hamilton, Gouverneur Morris are talking at this party, and Hamilton, who's probably about 21, 22 at the time, says, isn't it amazing that nobody touches General Washington? Everybody else, they shake hands, they touch, they pat each other on the back, but not General Washington. Nobody feels familiar enough to even touch this man. And Gouverneur Morris says, well, that's not true. I'm his age. I could certainly go up and touch him. Okay, Hamilton says, I will buy you and all those of us around you, I will buy you all dinner if you go up to George Washington, pat him on the back, say, how's it going, old boy? And so, after a sufficient amount of wine, Gouverneur Morris does this. And George Washington draws himself up and glares at him. And Gouverneur Morris returns and says, I have won the bet, but at great cost, and nothing would induce me to repeat it. So this isn't a man that people hang out with. This is a man people follow. This is a man people trust. But he's not everybody's buddy. And so he becomes hard to know, hard to understand through time. You know, we've had a number of events involving historical figures from this time period lately. We have a hit movie about Abraham Lincoln, directed by one of our most famous directors. We have a hit musical about Alexander Hamilton. My God, we even have a hit television show about John Adams. But what about Washington? Well, I would just say that George Washington is harder to get to know, but he is worth knowing. George Washington is the man who's going to encapsulate America. He doesn't encapsulate America the way Thomas Jefferson does. Jefferson's able to do it with his writings. Jefferson's able to do it intellectually. Washington does it by being America. I may quote this again for you at another time, but I'm going to share it with you right now. George Washington has just been named the general. And the interesting thing is he's been named general of an army that doesn't exist. He represents a country that hasn't been formed. He's fighting for independence that hasn't been declared. And he's going to travel from Philadelphia to the Boston area, to Bunker Hill. And this is what Gary Wills writes. He writes, before there was a country, before there was even a symbol of that country, a flag, a national seal, there was Washington. And what he means is this man, being as he was the ultimate showman, riding into town on his beautiful white horse, he was America. He was all we had. We didn't have a government. We didn't have an army. We didn't have anything. We had Washington. And from that day, throughout that war, it was going to be Washington who was going to have the pressure of carrying on with that war effort. It's going to be Washington who has to live with the knowledge that he's out there at Bunker Hill and that they really don't have any gunpowder to speak of. It's going to be Washington who has to live with the concern about how many of his people are staying in his army, how long the people are going to stay in that army, whether they're all going to go home at the end of their 1 year of service, whether they're going to go home before then, on and on and on and on and on. People talk about how presidents look after 8 years. Well, the same was true about George Washington. After 7 years of that war, it was said, I believe Fisher Ames said at his inaugural, time has wreaked havoc on his face. And no wonder. When you look at, and we're going to go through, his time during the Revolutionary War, and when you look at it, it's no wonder that time has wreaked havoc. It's no wonder that he looked very much more aged than before then. Well, before we get started on this 101 series, let me just say one thing that I alluded to earlier. Once upon a time, we had a holiday called Washington's Birthday. And then it was decided to make it Washington and Lincoln Day, because Abraham Lincoln, who was also president, and of course George Washington had been president, his birthday was close to Washington's. Then we decided, let's add all of the presidents. Let's turn the holiday from one which at least has some kind of meaning to it, which people can see and articulate, into another amorphous, vague, meaningless holiday. Those who would change the holiday from being called Washington's Birthday to President's Day are lacking a sufficient understanding of what the holiday was about. It wasn't about George Washington because he was the president. You know, John Adams, I love John Adams, but John Adams made a mistake about this as well. When he was president, he found it to be insulting that people continued to celebrate George Washington's birthday. He said, how can they do that? He's a private citizen, whereas I am the president. That shouldn't be done. It's improper. The truth is, they weren't celebrating Washington's birthday because George Washington had been president. They were celebrating Washington's birthday because he had been Washington. Because of all of the things he had done to help win the War of Independence and to get the Constitution ratified and to get the Constitution started and realized. They were celebrating the man who represented all of the people from his generation, who made that initial fight in order to create the country of the United States. And after you've listened to this podcast, I would ask you to, if you're convinced of George Washington's importance, whether you like him or not, you may feel that you have a bright line and that you cannot admire anybody who ever had slaves. And I can understand that. And I would never tell you you're wrong. You know, we all have bright lines when it comes to Nazis. Nobody says, well, he's a Nazi, but he's okay. If you feel the same way about someone who is a slaveholder, then how can I possibly tell you you're wrong? I can't tell you, as a lady who gave me the slave tour at Mount Vernon once told me, he's one of the good guys. I can't say that. What I can say is he's worth knowing and understanding and one day of the year acknowledging. George Washington is born at 10 o'clock in the morning on February 11th, 1732. Now, for those of you listening to this saying, wait a minute, he wasn't born February 11th. Everybody knows he was born February 22nd. There was a change in the calendar, and they had to catch some people up, so to speak. So his birthday of February 11th became changed to February the 22nd. Once upon a time, we celebrated it on February the 22nd until we decided, well, our holiday should only be on Mondays. In any event, He's born at 10 o'clock on February 11th, 1732, in Westmoreland County, in a place known as the Northern Neck, Virginia. He was the fourth generation of his family to be in Virginia. Now, I'm going to look a little bit into his roots, so to speak. His father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather. Now, there's some people who say this is a colossal waste of time. And I kind of tend to agree with them a lot of the times. Christopher Hitchens says he couldn't care less about anybody's parentage. And he doesn't care about his own particularly. And I have to say, I feel pretty much the same way, certainly when it comes to my own. I've never felt some driving curiosity to find out the lives of the people who were distantly related to me. But the story of George Washington is the story of coming to this continent. And it becomes important to us in knowing Washington because it was important to him. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. You know, I once had a two-volume book on Emily Dickinson, and she doesn't even get born until the second volume starts. So we're not going to go that far into it, but we are going to look a little bit into the antecedents of George Washington. In order to understand George Washington, you have to know where he came from and the society where he lived and where the people who came to Virginia, the society they created. Now, George Washington's a Virginian. Virginia is a class society. Family is of tremendous importance. When he first becomes a general of the army, he's going to be perplexed by this Massachusetts equality that was going on. He couldn't understand it. He said, "I can't tell the difference between the officers and the privates." This seemed like a terrible thing to him. It was kind of a compliment to some of the people from Massachusetts. But in any event, he stated that you have to know these people's families in order to know if you should make them officers, because you should only make officers people who are gentlemen. And you can't know if somebody's a gentleman if you don't know his family. So this is, of course, a very English way of looking at things. You know, if you look at English literature, so much of it is about people looking into their backgrounds, looking into their families, looking at where did they come from. That's what Great Expectations is about. It's what much of Dickens is about. You know, it's what George Eliot's books are about. Daniel Deronda. Daniel Deronda is an interesting one because she kind of flips the Dickens story on its head. Of course, with Dickens, people such as Pip are looking at their backgrounds to find out where they come from. It always turns out they come from somebody rich. Daniel Deronda thinks he comes from somebody rich, but he looks into his background and he finds out he comes from a Jewish family. Not something most people would choose in 19th century Europe, but he joyfully embraces his Jewish heritage because that's his heritage. So the idea is you have to understand where you come from to know who you are, a very British idea. Now, Nathaniel Hawthorne is going to write The Scarlet Letter, and what we get at the end of that book is a very American idea. We get at the end of the book Hester's idea of simply leaving and coming up with a new name and starting a new life. That's the way the literature is going to go in America. That's the way a lot of people feel about coming to America, but it's not the way George Washington feels, and it's not the way most Virginians feel. Now, the family patriarch, the one who came to Virginia initially, was John Washington. He came from England in 1657, and he established the Washingtons as respectable, though not extremely prominent, Virginians. John's father was the Reverend Lawrence Washington, and he had been preparing for an academic career, but he had been stripped of his cleric post in the wake of the English Civil War, and he became an Anglican rector who ministered to an impoverished parish in Essex. Now, we're not sure to this day what exactly the true story is here. Some people say that his downfall came from defending high churchmen. Others say that it came from drunkenness. But in either event, John was, as biographer James Flexner is going to put it, plummeted from affluence to squalor. He left the life of a gentleman and he became a sailor on a merchant vessel that landed him in Virginia. And that's where he's going to marry Anne Pope from a well-to-do family. Now, as we look at the lives of the Washingtons, we're always going to see that they want to advance socially. And one of the main ways they have of doing that is to marry women from well-off families, something George is going to do famously. John Adams is going to one day ask, would any of us have ever heard of him if he had not married Martha Custis? And it's a good question. After his wife died, John Washington married two sisters who had been accused defendants in front of him as the justice of the peace. Now, one was charged with keeping a bawdy house, and the other with being the governor's whore. James Flexner wrote this about John Washington. He transacted legal business sometimes before courts on which he himself sat. Having a passion for acreage, he used a legal trick to pull the soil out from under an Indian village. Many years later, when they met George Washington, the Indians remembered his great-grandfather and bestowed upon George the name Conotacarius. They told him this meant town taker. Well, George, he thought that they were just kind of giving him a somewhat meaningless compliment, but what they were actually doing was connecting him to his great-grandfather. That was the name they had given to him, and town taker was no compliment because he had taken their towns. John's son, George's grandfather, was Lawrence Washington, and he was an attorney who represented merchants in Virginia, and he died at the age 39, leaving a respectable estate. His second son, Augustine, would be George's father. Augustine was taken to England by a stepfather and spent 4 years there before returning to Virginia after his mother's death. He was a large, blonde, and famously strong man who spent much of his time trying to obtain property. Augustine's first wife gave him 3 children, but it was his second wife, Mary Ball, who would be the mother of George Washington. So, what does this information tell us? Who are these people? W.E. Woodward was one of the first biographers to take the negative side of George Washington. After so many hagiographies, he felt that it was time for a different interpretation of the father of our country. And when writing about his family, he wrote that Washington came of a family that must be called undistinguished unless a persistent mediocrity enduring many generations is in itself a distinction. Well, I like the writing, but it's not fair by a long shot. Washington's male antecedents were strong and they were passionate, and they married in order to gain social advancement and property. They were obsessed with land. They were obsessed with becoming not just gentlemen, but gentlemen of the highest order. And they died very young. And these are all things that George Washington knew. And these were all things that were going to give an impact to George Washington. Now, for those who wish to understand the relationship of George Washington and his father, you're going to have a very tough time. George's father died when he was only 11, and with his death died his dream of ever being educated in Europe. Now, 16 years after his father's death, he would still write about his longing desire to visit England, a desire that would never be achieved. We know very little about George Washington's relationship with his father. Of course, there's the Parson Weems story of him chopping at the cherry tree, of him saying, "I cannot tell a lie." What's interesting about that story is it could certainly be true. After all, Parson Weems had spoken to George Washington, knew George Washington. It's conceivable, though not probable, that this event happened and George Washington told him about it. People don't hate that story because it can't be true. They hate it because it's sugary and saccharine, and it turns him into the kind of goody-goody that you don't want to get to know. They hate it because it doesn't really give an honest portrayal of George Washington, because whether or not he lied on that day about that cherry tree, he certainly made a number of lies later throughout his career. You had to if you were a general. Every time you had a battle, you would make up who was injured, how many people were injured, how many of the enemy were injured. That was kind of just part of your job. He lied about other things as well. But we don't know a lot more about his relationship. George Washington only mentioned his father 3 times in all of the papers that we have of his. And in none of them Does he mention his father and give us any kind of elucidation on their relationship? We just don't know. We know, though, that his dream of becoming a European-style gentleman takes a big hit when his father dies. It changes everything. He's not, as I already said, he's not going to achieve that European education. He's being brought up by his mother, who, in the world of gentlemen and ladies, is not one who comes across as a sophisticated lady. Let's put it that way. It means Washington's going to have to engineer a different way up a more difficult terrain into becoming the type of gentleman that he wants to become. Now, George, as I've already said, was born of his father's second marriage. His two half-brothers attended their own estates, and George was the oldest child of his mother. Mary was, to many biographers, a very difficult woman. And we're going to hear about that as these podcasts continue. But, to be fair, she was in a very difficult situation. She had children. She was the second wife, so she didn't have the benefits that the first wife had. She didn't have a lot of money. She wasn't going to inherit the best land. So she had to be austere. She had to be tough. And as much as George disliked dealing with his mother, there's a lot of his mother in George. The sort of tough, penny-pinching, excruciatingly detailed person that she was is who George Washington's going to be. Without a father, George Washington looked to his eldest brother, Lawrence, as his surrogate father. And it does appear that Lawrence, in return, looked at George as his surrogate son. Lawrence had joined an American regiment of the British Army to fight against Spain, and he became a British regular who so admired the British admiral who he fought under, and he became a British regular who so admired the British admiral that he fought under, his name was Admiral Vernon, that he named his home Mount Vernon in his honor. Now, what do we know about the young George Washington? Well, we can assume he was more somber and a little bit more quiet and a little bit more reticent than others of his age. We assume that because of what he was like as he was older and from the fact that he loses his father at such a young age. We know that he was strong and that he was physically fit, that he sought quiet respectability. Now, what follows is a poem copied out in Washington's school book by Washington, and this is how it goes. These are the things which once possessed will make a life that's truly blessed. A good estate on healthy soil, not got by vice, nor yet by toil. Round a warm fire, a pleasant joke with chimney ever free from smoke. A strength entire, a sparkling bowl, a quiet wife, a quiet soul, a mind as well as body whole. Prudent simplicity, constant friends, a diet which no art commends. A merry night without much drinking, a happy thought without much thinking, each night by quiet sleep made short, a will to be but what thou art. Possessed of these, all else defy, and neither wish nor fear to die. Now you always have to tread a little bit carefully when assigning importance to schoolbook jottings. After all, they could just be exercises in penmanship. But there's so much in this poem that leads us to the George Washington that we know. This is not a poem that Jefferson or Adams or Franklin would admire. They're not looking at having happy thoughts without the effort of thinking. They're not just simply, they're not talking about wanting a quiet wife. And this is the life of a gentleman. This is the life of a gentleman who has attained what is due to him and who gets to reap the benefits of that. It's not a life of great passion, great anger, great work. It's a life of quiet, pleasant evenings. And one can easily understand George Washington looking at this poem and thinking, yeah, that's exactly the kind of life I want. That's exactly the kind of wife I want. Washington's outlook was the outlook of a British gentleman. The idea was to receive the bounties that one was entitled to. And there can be no question that George Washington felt throughout his entire life that he was entitled to these bounties. He was entitled to having a pleasant life of respectability with a quiet wife and a fire that gives heat, but no ashes. Now, how is he going to gain all of this? How is he going to have the kind of mansion he has in his mind? How is he going to be able to marry up and get a wife that's going to help him go higher in his societal yearnings? He's not the first son. He's not going to inherit anything. He's not going to go to Europe to be educated. So there's only one road left that he knows of, and that's the road that Lawrence, his brother, took. He's going to have to join the military, and he's going to have to become a British regular. He's going to need to achieve military success, and when he returns to Virginia, he's going to need to exchange that success for land and a wealthy wife and respectability. So he's looking across the ocean to the British for this. He wants to do exactly what his brother Lawrence did. His brother Lawrence, who names his home Mount Vernon in honor of a British admiral. Now, Virginia was a land of social distinction built upon British practices. Washington wrote out, copied from another book, the rules of civility and decent behavior in company and conversation. And this was a guidebook of etiquette that explained how to exist in a gentlemanly manner. It said things like this: shift not yourself in the sight of others, nor gnaw your nails. Bedew no man's face with your spittle by approaching too near him when you speak. Cleanse not your teeth with the tablecloth, napkin, fork, or knife, but if others do it, let it be done with a picktooth. The book gave rules not only for civility, but for understanding class distinctions and for towing important lines. In speaking to men of quality, do not lean nor look them full in the face, nor approach too near them. At least keep a full pace from them. Or, in writing or speaking, give to every person his due title according to his degree and the custom of the place. This book, so writes Washington biographer Ron Chernow, is a crib sheet for a world shot through with class distinctions and informed by a deep terror of offending one's betters. It taught, wrote William Guthrie Cyan, modesty, defense, and submission to authority. While these rules seem to intentionally keep people forever in their anointed place, there can be no question that Washington ultimately viewed himself not as the man deferring to others, but as the man others would defer to. It was just the matter of getting to that point. Now, Lawrence's education on how to advance in society would continue when he married Anne Fairfax, the daughter of Lord Fairfax, and a member of the most important family in Virginia. The residual benefits of Lawrence's marriage brought George into a world of high fashion and power. Colonel William Fairfax was land agent for the Northern Neck Proprietary, and his land grant dated back to the reign of King Charles II. The Fairfax family controlled 5 million acres. Through business dealings and marital ties, their power reached into every corner of Virginia society. And they immediately took a liking to George. They even arranged for George to become a midshipman at 14. Many biographers have looked at that and thought, what would have happened had George Washington joined the British Navy. Well, it wasn't going to happen because Mary Washington put a kibosh on it. She refused at the very last moment. He'd even packed his bags, but at the last moment, she refuses to give her consent after writing to her British brother, Joseph Ball, who told her that a common sailor before the mast has by no means the common liberty of the subject, for they will press him from a ship where he has 50 shillings a month and use him like a negro, or rather, like a dog. It's always a little difficult to figure out whether Mary Washington is doing something for George's benefit or for her own. Again, as Chernow muses, it was the first of many times she seemed to measure her son's worth not by what he might accomplish elsewhere, but by what he could do for her, even if it meant thwarting his career. She would always be strangely indifferent toward his ambitions, making decisions about him from a purely self-interested standpoint. Temporarily thwarted from his military career, George chose to become a surveyor. Now, why did he become a surveyor? Well, one reason is he found some surveying tools, some of which belonged to his father. But surveying offered him a life that suited him. It gave him freedom and physical exertion. And it was studying land, which is the most important thing for him or any other Washington. By surveying land, he had chosen a profession that would allow the Fairfaxes to send work his way, and almost immediately, they began doing exactly that. Now, we know that the Fairfax came to really like this young man, George Washington, but it's fair to ask just who was George Washington at this time. In many ways, he was not the George Washington we've come to know in our history books. He was ambitious, and he was unable to hide that ambition from others. Many said he had a volcanic temper, and this was the one failing in the eyes of his patrons, the Fairfaxes. Colonel Fairfax wrote to George's mother, "I wish I could say that he governs his temper. He is subject to attacks of anger on provocation, sometimes without just cause." He was particularly influenced by Seneca, a Roman philosopher and politician who emphasized sacrifice, tenacity, courage, restraint, and the control of one's emotions. Seneca was something he learned about from the Fairfaxes. Washington, like most men his age, found himself romantically interested in several different women. Now, we've heard about the Lowland Beauty, this woman who, like Shakespeare's Dark Lady, will be forever hidden from the prying eyes of historians. Writing to a friend, Washington described his feelings. "Where I might, as was my heart disengaged, pass my time very pleasantly, as there's a very agreeable young lady lives in the same house. But as that's only adding fuel to the fire, it makes me the more uneasy, for by often and unavoidably being in company with her, revives my former passion for your lowland beauty, whereas was I to live more retired from young women, I might in some measure alleviate my sorrows by burying that chaste and troublesome passion into the grave of oblivion or eternal forgetfulness." The first romantic interest we know of by name is Betsy Fauntleroy. George Washington asked her to marry him, and she refused. He then wrote to her father, and he promised to wait on Miss Betsy in hopes of a revocation of the former cruel sentence and see if I can meet with any alteration in my favor. True to form, Washington had asked a woman to marry him who was from one of the leading and richest families in Virginia, and perhaps her father felt that the young surveyor was aiming too high, higher than his prospects should have permitted. Washington even set his pen to paper at this time to record his inner romantic feelings. "O ye gods, why should my poor resistless heart Stand to oppose thy might and power. At last surrender to Cupid's feathered dart, and now lays bleeding every hour for her that's pitiless of my grief and woes, and will not on me pity take. I'll sleep amongst my most inveterate foes, and with gladness, with wish to wake, in deluding sleeping slept my eyelids close, that an enraptured dream I may, in a soft lulling sleep and gentle repose, possess those joys denied by day. Don't quit your day job. It was at this time that Washington had his first great romantic love, and that was for Sally Fairfax, the wife of his good friend, George William Fairfax. Now, she was about 2 years older than he was, and there can be no doubt that he was very much in love with her, and that times, in perhaps a completely innocent way, she would encourage him in his infatuation. Now, a psychiatrist might say that perhaps George Washington wanted everything his friend George William Fairfax had. He wanted George William Fairfax's rich father. He wanted his opportunities. He wanted his land. And he wanted his woman. And the historian has to ask whether or not Washington felt guilt about these feelings, or was this simply life in the strangely incestuous world of Virginia, where flirtation with married women was a common activity? We're going to hear more about Sally in the next episode. Now, thanks to the Fairfax family, Washington's going to get his first job, and it's going to be surveying a town that was at the head of the Potomac navigation. He is thrilled to take part in this surveying expedition, and he's going to write down the very first sentence in his very first journal. Began my journey in the company of George Fairfax, Esquire. This is where the adventure of his life really does begin, because in the next episode, we're going to hear about his early journeys, the Indians that he meets, and then how he's going to somehow, with great audaciousness and a certain amount of arrogance, place himself, convince the governor of Virginia to put him in a position of high responsibility and to send him out to that area in order to deal with French agents. Well, it's going to lead to a great world war. It's also going to lead to George Washington stepping out onto the world stage. You're not going to want to miss episode 2 of George Washington 101. See you then.